Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. Bristol Community FM's chair Ali Grant and manager Pat Hart have, however, suspended Dialect due to a nearly 30-minute long excerpt of a speech by Bible scholar Gail Ripplinger we aired in September 2015. But we should be back on BCFM soon. This week, Mark Kerridge from Positive Money. Also, the flying vet, Maurice Kirk. And we hope to bring you some scandal from Ujima Radio. Also, Dialect is produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. You can call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Mark Kerridge from Positive Money. Hi, Mark. Welcome to our pokey little studio here at People's Republic of Stokes Croft.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Actually, it could be worse, couldn't it? A reasonable amount of space. But tell us about Positive Money. What's this all about? We know money's a big problem in society at the moment. Apparently, there's not enough of it.
That's a sort of bit of a fallacy. But Positive Money, we're a monetary reform group and campaign organisation. We exist to educate on the way that banking and money creation really work, as opposed to the way most people think it works.
Now, is there actually a sort of finite amount of money that then gets shared out? Or because that's the way it sort of appears. It's almost like a commodity that there's a certain amount of, and it gets shared out in different ways and, you know, moves from person to person. Is that the way it works?
No, that's not the way it works. No. Money is created when banks make loans. So there's not one big pot of it. If banks decide to lend, then there's lots of money.
So the obvious question is there any limit on the amount of loans that banks can make? Because when they're doing that, they're making that money up out of nowhere.
Absolutely.
To lend it.
Yes.
So is there any limit? If I was a bank, can I just write my own checks as long as I want?
Well, no. When money is created by when banks make a loan, money is created at that point when the figure is tapped into a computer, the loan is agreed, click of a mouse, the money is created at that point. When the money is paid back, that money is destroyed. That's how the system of money creation works.
Okay, and how
far as the amount of money that is created by banks when they make loans, that's basically down to them and their confidence that loan or those loans will be repaid. If they're very, very confident and they think everyone's going to repay, it'll be fine, then they'll keep on lending, which is what caused the financial crash, especially in America.
Hang on a minute, because everyone calls it a crash. I try and, always challenge them, certainly, to say, no, it wasn't a crash. It was a bailout to avoid a crash. There was going to be a crash, possibly, but there was a bailout to stop it happening.
For sure.
There was definitely sort of worries that something was going to happen, and so therefore there was a massive loan made to the government to bail out those banks, basically buying up bank shares.
Yeah.
One of the things I've looked at this over the years that annoys me is that you've got this protection from the government, a certain amount of deposits in bank accounts.
That's right.
I don't know what they call that. And do you know how much it is?
I think it's just changed. I think it's just dropped to £50,000. It was 85,000.
Okay, so they're dropping that. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me because it means they're less exposed. The government are less exposed all the time.
Exactly.
I mean, if there's going to be a crash, sounds to me as if the government are almost expecting there may be a crash or collapse of banks.
Yeah.
If they're lowering that limit.
Maybe so. Certainly they want to reduce their own liability. I suppose on some levels, it's a deposit insurance, basically, government deposit insurance scheme. It insures everybody's bank account up to the value of, I think, £50,000,
okay,
if you've got that money in your account.
But look, here's the point. In 2008, they were bailed out really to save the savings of those who had more than £50,000 or £70,000. So if the banks had gone bust, it was only really the people who had more than that amount whatever it was, 70,000 at the time,
yeah.
who would have taken a hit. Actually, there's another group who would have taken a hit if they hadn't bailed the banks out. That's the bank shareholders. And if you're a shareholder in a business, I mean, surely you've got to take the rough with the smooth. I mean, this is where we are with all this. Anyway, tell me what Positive Money's analysis is of what's wrong and what you want to do about it.
The way the banks work, the fact is that they are money creators. Most people think that banks act as intermediaries between borrowers and savers. So somebody puts money into a bank as a saver, and then the bank organises a loan and lends that money out to a borrower. And that's not how it works. It's a very, very lucrative business. But it doesn't work in the interest of society as a whole.
Well, you say lucrative, but what happens if no one pays that loan back? Or the bank lends the money, creates the money, lends it, but then it disappears. They say, sorry, can't pay you back.
Well, then the bank goes bust. I mean, this is what could have happened in 2008 if the bailouts didn't happen.
The most recent bit of news is that Chancellor George Osborne was going to have a sale of the government's shares in Lloyds, and they've now decided, oh well, actually we better not do that because the bank isn't going to make very much money on the open market, and hopefully, if we fingers crossed behind our back, if we leave it for a little while, the taxpayer will get a better deal.
Yep.
So this we're at the mercy of the market on all of this sort of
very
thing, which
so.
Is obviously not good for something which everybody needs. It needs to be a utility. So I'll just come back to ask, what's the Positive Money vision for the way things should be run?
That we take away the power to create money from private banks and put the power to create money back into an independent and accountable body, basically.
Like who, for example?
Like who? Like currently the Monetary Policy Committee at the Bank of England. Certainly not politicians. You don't want to be giving politicians the power to create
money.
But
hang on, because the politicians would be appointing this central bank committee, the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee, surely is appointed by politicians.
I don't think the Monetary Policy Committee at the moment is appointed by politicians. They are appointed by a number of people.
Well, this is interesting, isn't it? Who does appoint them?
Exactly.
I was asking, this recently about judges. It turns out, actually, it's the Queen that appoints them. So she's got quite a lot of power there. Although there's recommendations are made by politicians about who should be appointed to those top judicial posts. So that would be quite interesting to find out who makes those appointments to the Bank of England. Because, of course, with the Labour Party, New Labour, as it was called, one of their first things in 1997 they did was to actually get rid of the power to raise or lower interest rates from the government and give it to the city.
Yeah.
How do you think...
Well, it's not really the city. Okay, so the Bank of England is... it's not a corporation. It's a state-owned bank. So it's not right to say... It's not true to say that the Bank of England is part of the city, as for say...
So it's controlled by the Treasury, effectively, is it, if it's a state-owned bank?
I wouldn't say no. It's independent, but it's not like the Federal Reserve in the States, which has actually got shareholders and is a profit making corporation in its own right. And to be honest, the Bank of England have done some really radical work looking at the way that money is created, examining this issue, which hasn't really happened. And certainly, it came out in 2014, first central bank to basically say, private banks create money. So they were the first to say that.
Admitting it, you know.
Exactly.
Rather than keeping it closed. I can always remember going into the Co-op Bank here in Bristol with a guy who, I suppose, I don't think he actually was a bank manager, but he was one of their staff there. He seemed to be the kind of manager character. And I said to him, is it right that you just create money up out of nowhere and lend it out at interest?
That's it.
And he looked at the floor.
Yeah.
He was quite good. He looked at the floor. He said, well, actually, yes. Yeah. Said quietly. So this is obviously a great deal of power that these private banks have.
Yeah.
Is there anything at the moment really calling them to account to make sure that they actually serve the public interest or rather than themselves? Because the two at the moment particularly seem to be diametrically opposed.
Mm.
The banks want to buy up as much as they possibly can of assets, whether that's public assets or whatever, our property on the cheap, whereas we would like them to share wealth out amongst people. So there seems to be diametrically opposed, the private interest of the private banking sector in the city and what ordinary people want seem to be almost the opposite.
Well, very much so. I mean, the power to create money is huge. And not only do they have the power to create money, therefore they control the amount of money that's created when they, you know, if they decide to make lots of loans or vice versa, they decide where that money goes.
Now,
and it's immensely sort of undemocratic.
These banks, some people say what they're doing is counterfeiting. It's not quite true because they are doing it under license. But the government could, George Osborne, if he wanted to, could pull those licenses, couldn't he? Could say
Absolutely.
To a bank, you know, okay, I'm going to take away your license to print money.
Yes, they could.
And did they do that? Is that power ever exercised?
That's one of the things that we're campaigning for. And we managed to get a debate in Parliament last year on money creation. First time in 144 years that had happened.
Wow.
So, but then on just before that debate, Positive Money, we got Dodds, who are a polling organisation, to poll MPs and ask them a number of questions, multiple choice, about how money is created. 10% had any idea of about how banking works and how money is created.
So it almost seems like a dark art they don't want you to know about.
It's something that hasn't been talked about for an awful long time. You know, to challenge the banks have huge power. It's the biggest business in the world, if you like. You know, this power to basically create money out of thin air and rent it to society as a whole. It's an immensely lucrative business.
Well, they talk about it as the financial services industry, but I'm not sure, is it really an industry, or is it just a sort of bunch of people shuffling bits of paper around?
Well, it's a very good business model if it's just shuffling pieces of paper around.
Also, you've got the situation of banks have a lot of power, don't they, over who they lend the money to.
Yes.
And then what happens if that person can't pay it back? Because they could either seize all their assets, take everything away, or they can just shrug their shoulders and say, OK, let's just write it off.
Yep.
And do they use that power? Because, I mean, I'm thinking particularly of the some of the industries that have built up around genetic engineering. A lot of those have been financed by banks. Basically, it was just an idea saying, well, we think we can do this with a human being or a mosquito and change it. And then when it turns out they can't, they just shrug their shoulders and say, fine, well, here's another loan to do something else with. It seems to be they've actually got much more political power than people realise.
Well, I mean, banks lending, what they tend to do is lend to property speculation and asset speculation. That's their main business model, if you like. That's what makes them most money. And when you're lending into the mortgage market, it's pretty safe for them. If you don't pay your mortgage, they take your house.
But this is all fueling a kind of asset bubble, isn't it? That you've got the property bubble.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, for example, buildings that you go past here in Bristol, we can, you know, probably something like a quarter of the buildings you go past, many are empty, and they are just being used, I suppose, as some kind of asset that someone says is worth something, but they're not actually proving it's worth what they say it's worth. It may be worth that to sell, but it's not actually able to generate the revenue because often the building is empty and they can't say, well, actually, this is making money and it's making this amount. If they were forced to rent it out, you might find the value goes right down, and if someone would look at it and say, well, actually, you're only managing to get this amount of rent for that building now. Mm. So how does all this property valuation link in with the financial crisis and the situation that we're in financially? Because it does seem to me there is a bubble there where they overvalued property.
Well, because banks like lending into property, because property has always been seen as a safe investment, they've just thrown money into this market. What that does is to create a bubble. Most people have an idea that the reason why property is so expensive, or is as expensive as it is right now, is because of demand and supply. But you've just pointed out that there are lots of empty properties kicking about.
Well, speculative money will go around the world looking for somewhere to invest in. And so the property is not just somewhere to live, it's also something to invest in.
Yes.
And that's like money in the bank, and it may be safer than something like the stock market.
Well, I think this is a problem of today's economy, and like generally, it's so financialized and it's so based on speculation as opposed to any real value. If you
okay,
like.
So what would Positive Money's idea of having this democratic, at least so-called democratic committee, monetary policy committee, or whatever, deciding who can make money, create money. What difference would that make to all of this?
Well, they don't decide on necessarily who can create money. The Monetary Creation Committee, as it would be called, Monetary Policy Committee sets interest rates, would decide how much money would be created. And this may be in conjunction with banks still continuing to make loans, if you like. It doesn't have to be an either-or situation. You could have what we call sovereign money, or what the Labour Party calls people's QE, because essentially they're the same thing. That going on at the same time as bank credit creation, as it happens.
For example, couldn't you just create people's QE, sovereign money, to just pay off all these PFI loans, which are crippling our hospitals, our National Health Service, right across the country.
This is all possible. But we had a huge chance after 2008 to change laws and reform banking, reform finance, and that opportunity was totally lost, which is a great shame. But, there will be I think there's going to be a chance again in the none too distant future.
How is QE, which used to be called printing money, it's now been called quantitative easing, how does it actually affect us? I mean, what changes does it make to the economy that we might see or we might not see?
Traditional quantitative easing or people's quantitative easing?
About both? Let's start with traditional QE.
Traditional QE is, although people call it money printing, it's not really that, because that money didn't really or hasn't got into the real economy. We've created in this country, I think, £375 billion worth of QE money. And that's funded the banks to with the idea that that would allow them to lend more into the economy and make the economy grow. What they actually did was use over 90% of it to invest in assets and property. And I think between 8 and 9% actually found its way into the real economy. So it did very little for the man in the street and the actual economy of this country. It did an awful lot for banks and their shareholders.
Oh, dear. This is...
It was a totally wasted opportunity.
Well, I mean, the thing is, there's financial crisis for everybody except the 1% who seem to have done rather nicely.
Yes.
Anyway, what about people's QE? What's that all about?
Well, so people's QE is... creating, if you like, what economists call broad money, which could be spent directly into the economy. The government would decide, okay, we've got, let's say, 10 billion. We create 10 billion of people's QE, and then the government can spend that how it likes. It could use it to pay down debts that it has. It could use it to... invest in the economy, in hospitals, in education, in building houses, if you like. Or it could fund a citizen's dividend, just give it away, drop it from a helicopter.
They've done that in Iceland, haven't they? I noticed that the Icelandic government have just actually decided to up all welfare payments. Anyone that's claiming welfare has got quite big increases over the last 3 or 4 years in Iceland, because the Icelandic government said, well, actually, these are the people who spend money. So probably a good idea to give them a bit more, and then maybe they'll spend a bit more and it'll help the economy generally.
Better than trickle down.
Well, yes. And also sanctioning blind people, disabled people who can't, necessarily jump over all the fences that Ian Duncan Smith sets up for them. Anyway, look, let's just talk, Mark, a bit about you personally.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about your background and what brought you to this campaign.
I had a sort of lingering doubt and curiosity about certain questions about why accommodation was so expensive, and this goes back many years. And I just couldn't figure it out. Sort of the reasons you gave earlier. So why is this so expensive? Why has it gone up so much? And then I discovered through reading, through searching on the internet, about how money is created, how money is created by banks when they make loans, as opposed to sort of the Bank of England printing it or gold or whatever. And it just seemed to me, this is crazy. That these private companies, they can basically create money out of thin air and then rent it to the rest of us. It's like, wow, what a great business model for them, how much it costs us. Then I discovered Positive Money, who they wrote a book, Modernizing Money, and I bought that, read that, was fascinated by it. Went to a conference up in London that they put on a couple of years back. And since then, I help organise the Bristol Group of Positive Money. So we get together about once a month at various places in Bristol and basically have a meeting, maybe watch a video, discuss anything that's happened in that previous month. And there is a lot happening at the moment. Iceland, you just mentioned, they're considering taking on the proposals, the sovereign money proposals, stopping banks creating money. There is a referendum in Switzerland on the same thing. That will be happening this year. They have in Switzerland, they have this People's Initiative. So if they get 100,000 verified signatures, then on that policy can then go to a referendum. And they had a campaign to promote sovereign money, and there's going to be a referendum on that later this year. It's an exciting time for monetary reform.
Well, I mean, here's a question for you. Does it make any difference, Britain being in or out of the euro?
The euro? Not the EU, the euro.
Yeah.
Because the euro
countries have done really horrendously, a lot of them anyway. Spain and Italy and Greece particularly.
Yeah, shocking what happened to Greece. And
a lot of Greeks are angry. In fact, they're pointing their fingers at the Germans and saying, actually, you're using your banks like you used to use your tanks.
Absolutely. I think to the point that's true. I mean, if a country can issue its own currency, then basically that country cannot go bust. If that country has to rely on another currency, as is the case with Greece with the euro, then...
So why don't they go back to the drachma then?
Because I think that would have been very difficult. They didn't have enough time to come up with a valid plan. They certainly would have been frozen out of the European Union payments system, which would have made it very, very difficult to buy and sell goods within the EU if they just sort of gave up the euro and went back to the drachma. I think Yanis Varoufakis, who was the finance minister, was working on some plans to leave the euro and go back to the drachma. But it's a very serious thing to do. I mean, you know, to crash out.
Well, why is it? It seems like it's a one-way street. You know, it's like the Hotel California. You join and you're never going to leave.
Well, I don't think it's a... Well, many people think that the euro has had its time, that it's not fit for purpose at the present time.
Well, it depends what its purpose was, doesn't it, when it was created. If it was to rob the whole of Europe with a smile, maybe it's been very successful.
Yeah, I'm not as cynical as that, but, you know. But, yeah, I don't... I think it's a very good move that this country didn't enter the euro. I think it would be disastrous.
Okay, let's give you the top job, put you in George Osborne's shoes.
Wow.
What would you be doing tomorrow if you had that job to straighten our money system out?
I would enact some legislation to basically make sovereign money happen. So I would give the Bank of England the power to simply create money. Not too much, and set up this monetary creation committee, make sure that it wasn't, I mean, you don't want to create too much money and just throw money all around because that's very inflationary, but that's what I'd do. That would be the first thing. And then look at limiting the power of the banks to actually lend, which is a little complicated. It's something I don't think it's a good idea just to stop them creating money overnight. You know,
got a great graduated process.
Yeah.
There's only one problem, you're not in the Bullingdon Club.
Yeah, I know.
So you can't get the job yet. I don't know how you managed to get to join it. Anyway, Mark, just give us listeners an idea of whereabouts to find Positive Money here in Bristol physically as human beings down a pub or wherever, and also online.
It is, actually. Okay, so we meet every month. Next month we are meeting at the Greenbank Pub in Easton on the 23rd, which is a Tuesday. At 7:30, we have a guy called Frank Laverne who's coming down from London, the head office in London, to talk to us about what he's been getting up to, which should be really, really interesting. But probably the best and the easiest place to find Positive Money is online at positivemoney.org. So it's a very good website, explains the issues in depth, lots of videos, not really difficult. you know.
How about the local group? Have you got an email address or a phone number?
The easiest way to find us is on Facebook. We have Bristol Positive Money. If you simply search for Bristol Positive Money on Facebook, there is a group which we keep updated with what we're getting up to, where the meetings are, you know. Facebook,
I suppose that, you know, there's something else I ought to ask you about, really. It's just the Bristol Pound. Is it any use?
I think the Bristol Pound is great. I think it's over 2 million Bristol Pounds in circulation at the moment. And that's really, really good. I mean, it certainly could be bigger. It could be used more. It could expand more. But the point of supporting local business and enterprise through a local currency, I think, is a fantastic idea.
All right, Mark Kerridge from Positive Money here in Bristol. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And I'm joined now by Tony Cripps. Tony shares some of the offices here with us here in the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. And he's a video journalist, freelance video journalist. Hi, Tony. Welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for letting me be here.
So it's the two Tonys. But so it might be a little bit confusing. But anyhow, Tony, tell us a bit about how you got into journalism and video in particular.
Originally, it came about during the 90s. And I was on a campaign down in Devon. On the A30, actually, it was Fairmile, which is became pretty famous back in the day for people like Swampy and, you know.
So it was a road protest.
Yeah, it was a road protest, and in particularly, it was a road protest about trying to stop a scheme that John Prescott and a load of associates of his had put together called DBFO, and that stands for Design, Build, Finance and Operate. Very, very quickly, what this was a consortium of companies, building companies and contractors thrown together by the government, subsidised by the government to build a stretch of road, which the government would then pay them a shadow toll on. For each car that used the road over 20 years, after which part of the agreement was that the government would then buy the road back off of the consortium.
Well, it sounds like a privatised motorway.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And would they have been toll roads or not?
They would have been toll roads, yeah, but the shadow toll, Tony, works in a different way to, say, a péage in France or the rest of Europe. You don't actually give money every time you use it. What happens is the government, through taxes and things, pays the consortium a figure based on the number of vehicles using.
So why didn't you like it? Sounds like a good idea.
Well, yeah, but it was about... it's not a good idea, Tony, because the consortium were a conglomeration, if you like, of various different companies selected by the government. They were doing back then, Tony, exactly what they're doing now, government, that is. They're giving their mates jobs, you know, to feed their own pockets, because as sure as hell they're not going to give, you know, these rich developers work. And, you know, take them into a consortium, an elite, if you like, if they weren't getting something out of it themselves as well.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that got you fired up. Pick up a camera. What did you do?
Yeah. Well, actually, I didn't pick up a camera straight away. What I did was I lived about a mile and a half away from Fairmile, where the campaign, the road protest, was going on. And, you know, so... We had a lot of protesters coming through the village. It was a little place called Ottery St Mary in East Devon. Some people may know it. You know, saw all these people, got to know people, actually looked into what was going on and thought, well, hold on a minute, you know, I'm going to get involved in this particular campaign because it's wrong. If what they're saying is right, it's wrong. Went along there, joined a camp called Trollheim. There were three camps to the A30 campaign. The main camp that people will remember was called Fairmile. And another two camps were there as well, separated by about a mile and a half, a quarter of a mile to Trollheim from Fairmile, and about a mile and a half to the third camp. So there were three camps on the A30 campaign. I was on Trollheim predominantly, and a couple of weeks after being there, Trollheim, Fort Trollheim was a big wooden fort with, you know, high walls, battlements, cauldrons and all sorts of things, and lots of defences, tunnels underneath it where people would go and lock on in the event of an eviction and, you know, carry out the eviction for as long as they can, like, you know, stay locked on for as long as they can. The idea of that was to cost the evicting company and the construction companies as much money as we possibly could, which we thought that's the best place to hurt them. And about 2 weeks after arriving at Trollheim for the first time, I've sat there one evening and I've noticed that there are a group of people setting up a tripod and a camera in the middle of the camp. And when I asked a couple of the other protesters there, well, you know, what's going on there? They said, oh, it's the BBC. They, you know, they always come along. They just come along and set up. And so I thought that was a bit rude and went across and asked the presenter and the team there, you know, what they were up to. They said, oh, don't worry. We're just going to do some shots for the GVs for the 6 o'clock. We'll be gone soon. And it's like, well, hold on a minute. No. You can't just walk into somebody's house like this and set a camera up.
But it wasn't your house, it was the woods.
It was our home. It had been built as a fortification. It had been built as an encampment, a secure encampment.
So you had a bit of a Barney with the BBC.
So I had a bit of a Barney with the BBC there and then, Tony. And I said to them, look, you know, if you want footage, come to us. You know, come to us. We'll give you the footage. And you can buy it off us because we need campaign funds anyway. And the BBC at the time said, well, we don't know about that. We don't buy footage. They soon actually got to start. So that's how it started. And I went off and bought a video camera, a couple of video cameras, cheapo cameras from the local shops, and started filming them as they were filming us, and we started filming the bailiffs whenever they came to visit. And
so actually at the end of the day, although the BBC were paying, they were actually probably getting better footage because they'd got...
Well, of course they were, because we were able to go, you know, into places where they couldn't possibly go.
So you were their eyes and ears in a way.
Yeah, well...
And so that's
yeah,
how you got started yeah. as a freelance. Now let's just talk a little bit about the media, the way it works, because yeah. since the late 1990s, there's been even more consolidation of the media. That is to say, it's in fewer and fewer hands. There's less and less editors in London. Almost all of our national and international news, pretty much 100% of it, comes from London. The regional news is a lot better in a way because it's not totally controlled, but London is controlled, very much so. And just looking at a diagram I've got here, this is from Free Press, which is the journal of the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom. A lot of retired journalists actually involved in this. This is number 205, winter 2015-2016. And you can find the website online at cpbf.org.uk. That's Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom at .org.uk. They're saying here, they've just done a survey of who owns the media, which is always a good thing to see from time to time, especially how it's changing. Radio, a lot of people get their news from radio. Yep. We're on the radio now. 99% of commercial radio news is provided by Sky. Now, that goes to the two massive independent commercial radio stations like Heart, people like that. They are owned by Global and Bauer. Now, nearly half of all of our radio stations are owned by those two companies. But 99% of our commercial radio news is from Sky.
Well, it doesn't really surprise me, Tony. You know, this goes hand in hand, really, doesn't it, with governments, you know, and agendas, basically.
But even the government sometimes are finding it difficult, particularly if they're a left wing or the opposition, to get their view out, because the media is owned by people who have a particular political agenda, may even be Tory party donors.
Well, yeah, I mean, the media is owned by people. I mean, the BBC are owned by the people of this country, Tony. And yet they seem to be continually working towards or working for government agendas.
Right.
You know, and
that's because the government appoints the bosses of the BBC, and often it leads to the situation where you've got journalists who are afraid to challenge, and there's this kind of self-censorship kicks in. Although, a good example, I think, is Newsnight. Over the years, it has been, I can remember years ago meeting one of their editors called Sean Kevill. Very balanced, very good. This is in the late 90s. Whereas slowly but surely, you found all the best reporters on Newsnight. I don't know if you've noticed, like Paul Mason.
Yeah, they all seem to go
Michael
that
Crick,
way, yeah.
Jeremy Paxman, yeah. Various of them either leave completely or they go over to Channel 4 News.
Well, yeah, I wonder why that is. Channel 4. I don't know, Tony. I mean, I don't particularly follow many of these sources
London media,
at all,
the
really.
London media, isn't it, really, this lot?
Yeah.
I mean, we're looking at a diagram here of the number of different... I mean, that is newspapers, television and radio news, and there's really just a handful. We're talking about maybe 20 organisations altogether, and the vast majority is News Corporation, Rupert Murdoch, over a third now of Britain's media. And actually, that if you look at it a little bit more deeply into there, you'll see it's magazines, books, journals, professional journals, all these sorts, everything. They're not just into radio and television.
I know, it's frightening, isn't it? When you consider the control that this very few people have over the entirety of it.
There is one other ingredient in all of this, that's community radio.
Community radio.
What's your experience
brilliant.
Of it here in Bristol?
Well, here in Bristol, I was involved with a guy called Mikey Jenkins, also a very, very well-known musician as Lodos, and that was his radio name. I was involved with a show with Mikey for about a year, called the Get to Know Show on BCFM, and that's Bristol Community Radio here in Bristol, where we developed a show, or the Get to Know Show, if you like, over a period of time. And it kind of incorporated, mainly politics and talking about local issues. And, we also had a spot in it, which normally went for about 15 to 20 minutes, where we bring in a local music artist and, we talk to them about what inspired them, what advice they'd have for up-and-coming, artists. We'd let them plug their music. We'd play their music on the show, to let them get that out and talk about their up-and-coming events. And go on to other... They're also sort
Is
of
Is that
like,
show still running?
No, the show's not running now, Tony. No.
So what happened?
Well... As I say, we were running that show for about a year, and then UGMA approached us and said that they would like us to take the show to UGMA, for which they could give us a two-hour slot on a Friday afternoon between 2 and 4. And, 2 hours, we were doing a one-hour show, Tony.
So you did that, did you?
Well, yeah, we decided to go along with that. We went along to the first show. Sat there, started it up, and about a third of the way through, the phone rang, and I carried on talking, to the mic, and Mikey was on the phone, and when he put the phone down and we brought some music up, he said to me, "Look, you've got to cut back on the politics. You're not allowed to hit them with such heavy politics."
Well, tell me, what were you talking about? What kind?
I can't
politics?
Remember the actual story at the time, Tony. But part of the show was that on occasion I would be outraged at something, and that would be the tempo that we'd work at.
So, what happened to that show then?
Well, we did that first show, Tony. There was a second phone call, and it was the director again. We were plugging an artist and talking about his up-and-coming events. Another phone call, and we're being told that we're not allowed to do that. We're not allowed to plug local artists. They have to go for advertising. And we decided...
Sorry, who is the director?
His name, I don't know his surname, but his name was Kevin. Mike had done all the arrangements and things with
him. So you were being told, no, you can't plug a local artist, they've got to pay the advertising money
basically,
to get
we
on.
We weren't allowed to run our show as we had been asked to take to UGMA. So we decided there and then that was the first
it's
and last show we'd do for them.
It's almost a form of possibly sabotage, because you're
Pretty
being
much.
Told, why not come here? It's all going to be wonderful, bigger, longer.
Absolutely.
And then you find, no.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have been invited since back to BCFM. by Pat Hart. And as soon as I get the time, Tony, you know, I'd like to go back and get involved again.
But anyway, it just shows you, doesn't it, that personalities and control can actually rule the roost. I mean, even hospital radio is one of the things I've experienced. Some crazy power control freaks running that as well in various places. Some of them are brilliant.
It's very hard to prove, though, sometimes, especially when you're in up to your neck in the middle of it. You know, but in hindsight is a lovely thing. And, you know, and it was a mistake that, you know...
I think this is almost a spiritual battle that we've just got to keep trying to tell the truth, because there's always someone out there that seems to want to shut us up.
Yeah, strange anyway, that, isn't it?
Lovely to talk to you, Tony.
You too,
and,
Tony.
The two Tonys. hope to have you on here again, maybe talking some politics in the future.
Yeah, that'd be lovely.
Look forward to it. Tony Cripps, video journalist, freelance journalist, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And joining me in the studio is the flying vet. Yes, it's Maurice Kirk, without his Piper Cub or any of his Piper Cubs in various states of disrepair and airworthiness. Maurice, you've been in the Royal Courts of Justice, haven't you?
Yes, hot foot yesterday. A bit of legal precedent has been made yesterday, which will be circulated throughout all the law courts of England and Wales.
So, I mean, I hate to be so cynical, but I think quite a lot of these cases are stitched up behind the scenes. Tell us a bit about the background to yours.
Well, over the last 40 years, I've learnt how the system works, and therefore this was a judicial review application, and I set up someone else to do it, so my name wasn't attached. Basically, I was in prison, in Cardiff Prison, having arrested a prison officer who had been told, which I cannot prove, not to hand over my passport when I was released from custody for an alleged breach of a restraining order.
Hang on a minute, because you say you arrested a prison officer?
Yes, because they would not give me back my passport because, this is, I strongly suggest, they knew that my legal papers against the South Wales Police for a civil damages claim that has gone on for 23 years, which puts Jondyce and Jondyce in the shade from Bleak House, isn't it? And they wouldn't give me my passport back, so I couldn't. So I went down to the passport office in Newport, and they'd been tipped off not to give me a new one. So I then went to the police station in Newport and made a complaint against to a certain sergeant. And still I couldn't get my passport back. So
why did you need your passport particularly?
To cross the channel. I've been known to cross the channel in a canoe, aeroplanes, without paperwork. But this happened to have been what you'd call a totally lawful route on Brittany Ferries. Anyway, to my cottage in Brittany, where I have hidden in certain buildings in a 5-mile radius the serious documents to sue the South Wales Police. Can't have them in this country, England or Wales, for obvious reasons. So I went back to the prison, waited for the doors to open for the prison van to come in from Crown Court with all the rogues that they have convicted that day. May I suggest some of them were rogues, not all of them, and slipped in before the door shut. And I demanded my passport back. And when they wouldn't give it back, I arrested the prison officer, a man called Rogan, in front of three other prison officers and seven cameras inside from the back of the prison and to the outside in the car park and inside what they call the lock, the vehicle lock. And I called the police to have him taken away because I'd arrested him for perverting the course. Well, for theft, basically. No, helping theft. And so I was then arrested for assault.
So this is a citizen's arrest you're trying to do here. Are you familiar with the law on citizen's arrest?
You're talking to Maurice Kirk. I would call it a private person's arrest, but I think I'm out of date now because I used to do this back in Taunton days back when I used to borrow chief constables' notebooks and things. They now seem to, I think I've lost the argument, they now call it a citizen's arrest, yes. But I'm a subject of Her Majesty, not a citizen of this country. May I make that absolutely clear? Not wishing to give away my politics. Getting back to the issue, I arrested Mr. Rogan, who thought the whole thing was a joke. But when I went to court, His Honour Judge... I've forgotten his name now. There are so many judges in Cardiff. Anyway, he would not let Janet, who lives here in Clifton, my lovely wife I jumped to the wedding to from the parish, for being the first in the world. I've told you that once before. She came over to take notes because I'm getting very deaf, having flown aeroplanes with no radio, therefore you don't waste your time on a radio, therefore you don't wear a headset, and you save money for fuel. And therefore I am now going deaf and a little bit stupid. And therefore, they put you nowadays in Wales in a sort of goldfish bowl. It's sort of bulletproof glass when you're in the dock. I think it's to protect me because I'm so popular, but other people have suggested it's to protect the general public from me. But you can't hear anything. So Janet tried to take notes, and the judge, his name will come to me in a minute, the judge said, no, you cannot take notes. So another day goes by, and somebody comes down from London. He was so annoyed, he came down, and he took notes. And he was refused, because they all knew I couldn't hear what the court case was about. Oh, I didn't have any lawyers, by the way, because I couldn't get one. And the HMP Cardiff would not give me my court papers in order to do my case. It's anyway, to cut a long story short, I was convicted and sent to prison for assault. And I appealed, and I was in Swansea Prison. And the High Court, because I put in what we call a state of case situation, where I make the judge, Judge Crowther, bless him, to give a state of case. He had to put in law regulations why I was in breach of the summary offence of common assault. And I took it to the High Court. But when I had to go, I was in a wheelchair because of all these problems I've got. The prison told Mr. Justice, I can't remember names anymore, that I refused to get on the bus, on the coach, you see. So I, what do you call it, the prison van. Well, yesterday, the gentleman who came down from London took them to court before His Honour, Mr. Lord Justice Sweeney and Lord Justice His Honour Judge Crowther, who refused Janet to take notes because I was inside this goldfish bowl.
So hang on, so is she in the public gallery there and he's saying, yes, you're not allowed to take notes?
Yes.
Well, that's, I think that sounds like Judge Crowther should be arrested.
Well, it's contrary to the Ministry of Justice rules, section, I think it's 1.5 of the rules, which lay down the regulations relating to, because remember, the whole purpose of watching people taking notes, the judge is running the risk that they are going to go and broadcast word for word what's being said.
Oh, no,
That could influence the witnesses or the jury.
Well, that's up to an individual as to whether they're going to broadcast something, and it's the responsibility of the journalists or radio stations as to whether that gets broadcast. Not the idea that you can't take notes in court, to me, sounds like rather fascistic and draconian. If it's going to be an open court.
Yeah, it opens.
If justice is going to be seen to be done, you've got to be able to take notes.
Yes, but the judge, I'm on the judge's side on where he has to keep an eye to make sure there's no risk, what we call real risk, of what's going on in his room in front of him could cause a mistrial. And therefore, if he sees somebody writing, they normally get permission. But in Wales, as was said by their lordships yesterday, things are a little different in Wales, whereby you are actually refused.
Are they? Is it all run by Freemasons?
I have just left the Royal Courts of Justice with a huge shot in my arm of trying to restore my confidence in the British judicial system. And I have avoided the Freemason system for the last 40 years in my writings on websites, various websites that I have. But this one, I need to give you the information. And I think Freemasons is the outcome, because the judgment comes on Monday. Then we'll see whether the Freemasons have stepped in to do something to quash it.
Okay, so anyway, carry on with your story. What was happening at the High Court?
So, their lordships ruled. Now, this is Lord Justice Sweeney and Lord Justice Burnett. Both are on the news on a regular basis, you may remember. And with my age and my experiences of diagnosing animals, I find myself at this age that I can look and assess people from a distance like my father could with sick animals. And as soon as I went in the courtroom, I realised, hang on, we've won this. But I didn't want to be seen because, of course, I'm the appellant, and the outcome of this case means that I may have an overturned prison sentence. So their lordship said, Mr. the gentleman who was presenting the case, you win on common law. Because the common law is exactly what you just referred to just now, that it is an accepted freedom of speech, that you should be allowed to write whatever, unless it's interfering with the court case. Well, there was no evidence to His Honour Judge Crowther that what he was doing, this gentleman in the gallery in Cardiff Court, was interfering with the process of my proceedings appealing a common assault.
Okay, so what's the outcome then?
Their lordship said, you win. We don't wish to refer to the Human Rights Act because we were both very upset about the Human Rights Act, which is an abortion of the real thing, which is the European thing, which is going to reflect on our EU situation with our present MP, by the way, but the Prime Minister. But then they said, we win. We will go. They will come back on Monday in the Royal Courts of Justice, where they will hand down the judgment with their findings, which will become law. I think in Wales they're having to shoot some Welsh sheep and skin them and get the hide sorted so that their lordships can have it sort of woded onto for the records of our law alongside the... what was that one down on Runnymede Road?
The Magna Carta. But what does it mean for you?
Well, it means that my conviction of arresting the prison officer, the whole case is in doubt because I didn't have a fair trial. And, of course, the transcript, they've had the transcript, which I've only been reading this afternoon because I've never seen it before. And, of course, because I was deaf, I couldn't hear what was going on in court. And he refused me the witnesses of the named prison officers who were witnessing me arresting Rogan. And I'm too old and tired in the prison fighting the bigger picture, the civil damages claim against the police, that I let that slip through. But I did go to the High Court. And, of course, the same prison prevented me from getting on the bus. Well, sorry, I was on the bus, but they've told the judge that I wouldn't get on the bus. I was on the bus in my wheelchair, filmed by their machines. So when the HMP are now worried about having to hand over their records, that I had a mistrial in the High Court.
Don't you ever feel like these lawyers are tossing you backwards and forwards, making money out of you?
Oh, perish the thought. Really? I congratulated the prosecuting barrister, that is the man, representing the police. And I said, you were dead in the water from the start, but I have to congratulate you. May I shake you by the hand? Because you put up a damned good fight. And he said, where do you live, by the way? And I said, you're talking about the South Wales Police. They always wanted to know exactly where I am. I said, well, I'm going back to my little cottage in Brittany to contemplate my navel, to plan for flying to South Africa. And I'm only there because I got a little drunk on Calvados 12 years ago because I come from Somerset and my father was an expert and I had an argument in the pub there in France and walked into an auction and the enchère à la bougie and so on and so on. And I said, I used to bribe the prefects in Taunton School. He said, I was a prefect in Taunton School, Somerset. What a wonderful way to finish a win. We wiped the floor of them.
What about your passport? You got that back then?
Oh, I have several. It's all right. Don't worry.
Maurice Kirk, thanks very much for joining us again on Dialect, and keep us up to date in the future with how this case goes. That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. It's been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Mark Kerridge from Positive Money and Tony Cripps, the video journalist. Also, Maurice Kirk, the flying vet, who has his ongoing saga for compensation from South Wales Police after he evicted the son of a superintendent from South Wales Police for drug dealing. And also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. So, that was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Overseer, overseer. sound of the